From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, why healthcare continued to add jobs even in a deep recession, plus where Californians stand on prisons, pensions, and candidates for governor and Senate. A new poll has the answers. Also, a dance show in Sacramento celebrates 50 years of Motown and new indie releases on this week's Sound Advice. But first, President Obama's State of the Union address last night focused on jobs, but he also talked about healthcare, a priority of his first year in office. Overhaul of the nation's healthcare system seems stalled since the Democrats lost their supermajority in the Senate, but Obama called on lawmakers to keep moving forward. How are Californians reacting to this? Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter Kelly Weiss joins us from our Capital Bureau. Kelly, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Who did you talk with, and how did they react to what President Obama said last night about moving forward on healthcare?
Well, you know, a lot of the usual groups who issue statements about healthcare and various legislative initiatives, whether it be in California or in Washington, were pretty quiet about President Obama's speech. There wasn't a lot of new things that he said or a lot of specifics, but I did talk with some people. There was a statement released from Californians for Patient Care. That's an advocacy group for patients, making sure people can get access to care, that it's safe, quality, as we know, advocating for patients. Anyhow, this group said they were happy to hear that the president is still committed to healthcare reform, but they want to make sure that it happens. And as you mentioned, Jeffrey, it seems to be stalled at the moment. In the president's address, he did not offer a timeline for when he wanted the legislation to be passed and on his desk so he could sign it. And he didn't really offer any solutions about how the stalemate can be overcome between Democrats and Republicans. So that's something, of course, groups that are in strong support of changes for insurance reform and for patients, not so happy about. Still optimistic, but waiting for more details is sort of the pulse that I have from the advocacy groups. As far as a state response, did talk with a contact with the California Health and Human Services Department that oversees our Medicaid program for the poor, also the Children's Health Insurance Program known as Healthy Families, and many other healthcare and human services programs. Anyhow, the state's reaction at this point is, as well as advocacy groups, good to see the discussion is still on the table to offer some changes and improvements to our healthcare system. But, you know, our governor, Schwarzenegger, has, said on the record many times that he's concerned as far as what it could cost California if overhaul goes through. The state estimates it could carry a price tag annually for California of $3 to $4 billion, and we all know that in our budget climate right now, that seems like a lot of money, and the questions are, how can we foot the bill?
Any sense from what President Obama said and how he said it and what the response has been, any sense as to how likely there's going to be some significant overhaul of the national healthcare system this year?
Well, I think we would all like to know that answer. It's hard to tell. As we saw the president opening his address and spending the majority of time in his speech was about jobs and the economy. So, we know that last year, it seems at this point, last year his push was much stronger for overhaul. And it really, again, is unclear that there hasn't been a stated timeline from him about when this legislation will come through or how it's going to happen. So, he did call on Republicans and said, if you have a better way to do this, if you have ideas, I'm listening. Let's see what you have. So he is still showing that he is open to any Republican plan or potential compromise on health care legislation. I think we're going to have to wait and see.
Kelly Weiss is Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter. Kelly, let's turn now to a story that you're working on that's going to air tomorrow. It's part of the Road to Recovery series. That's a collaboration between Capital Public Radio and the Sacramento Bee. It's reports about how the Sacramento region could be moving into recovery mode after the Great Recession. And your story tomorrow, given your beat, focuses on healthcare. What's your story about?
Well, I decided to focus on a group of healthcare jobs that we might not really think about that often. They're called allied health professionals, and they are the people who are not the doctors, nurses, pharmacists, or dentists, but they are the nurse's aides, they're the lab assistants, they're the respiratory therapists, the ambulance drivers. And these jobs actually account for about 60% of all jobs in the healthcare-related field.
Do these tend to be higher skill or lower skill jobs?
Right, Jeffrey. They're usually lower skilled. You don't need to go to medical school. You don't have to get training that a dentist would have. Often these jobs, you can get a few weeks training and get licensed by the state and be in it without a college degree. Some require a college degree and maybe a year or two of additional training. But yes, as you mentioned, lower skilled.
Now, you spoke with a specific so-called allied health professional. Tell us who that person was and what she does.
Well, I met a woman named Lindsay Westerbeck. She's 29 years old, not that far removed from college, and she is a clinical lab scientist. And that means that she works at Sutter Memorial Hospital. She's in a laboratory. She's a generalist and looking at all kinds of samples from patients that they're going to give when they get a lab test and looking for blood clots, vitamin deficiencies, cancer markers, a multitude of things. She got into this job having a biology degree from Sacramento State and 1 year training at UC Davis Medical Center to become a clinical lab scientist.
Well, this is obviously not a bedpan cleaning type of job.
No, this is one of the higher skilled jobs. And in fact, around the state, I've been told that these lab scientists get paid on average more than $60,000 a year. And there's a lot of job security here because there is a shortage of these workers while demand is increasing and fast. We know that California's population is growing, including Sacramento's, and there are more baby boomers who are aging, and that means they need more of these tests and more health care.
But there is a possible problem in all of this because all of these future allied health professionals, these lab scientists and so on, need training, but that's at issue right now, isn't it?
That's right, Jeffrey. I spoke with the regional lab director for Sutter. Her name was Christine Flaherty. She's in charge of hiring all of these, the lab workers. And she said, we really need these workers because the scientists we have are aging and getting ready to retire. But guess what? We don't have the workers to fill those jobs and the numbers that we need. And here's what she said about trained workers ready to enter the field.
The programs in the state right now are turning out about 125 CLS grads a year. The vacancies across the state are predicted to be around 390.
But if these jobs pay $60,000 a year or more, they're secure, they've got good, stable prospects for the future, why aren't people lining up to get the training?
Right. Well, you know, it all goes back, it seems everything does, to our state budget. I can't say it all is attributed to that, but it's a major factor because the state budget is funding the programs that train these workers. And there have been significant budget cuts at the community college level as well as four-year universities. And that's where these potential workers would go to get training. And not only is it budget cuts, but the faculty who teach these courses and run these programs, they're also aging and retiring.
My guest is Kelly Weiss, Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter. We're talking about prospects for job growth and what kind of jobs those would be in the healthcare sector. It's part of Capital Public Radio and the Sacramento Bee's Road to Recovery series. Kelly, more generally, the healthcare job sector, how's it doing right now and what are the prospects?
Well, when you look at labor statistics and where job growth has been, healthcare is one of the few sectors around the country who has had growth, even during the recession. So going into healthcare, trying to get a job in this field, looks pretty promising. It's the major question is, will the programs to train these workers be available to meet, as I said, the growing number of people who need the services?
Now, you said earlier that we're talking here about these so-called allied health professionals. These are people with jobs that require some skill, but they're not the doctors, the RNs, the dentists, and that sort of thing. Why not the doctors and RNs and so on? Those are the highest paying jobs, aren't they?
Right. What do you mean?
Well, why are we talking about the growth in the lower paying jobs and not the higher paying jobs? Is there no projected growth in those areas?
Well, you know, nurses, definitely there is growth in the nursing sector. There's some of the same challenges, of course, having the educational programs and being able to keep up with the attrition rate of older nurses retiring. But the thing about allied health jobs is it makes up the majority of healthcare-related jobs. So when you're looking at growth, as far as sheer numbers and the need that they fill, that's a wide variety, whether they're in the laboratory or they go to people's homes and they're home care aides or they're working in the clinic directly with patients, assisting nurses or doctors. So, you know, there's a wide variety. So allied health often is overlooked because they call it the hidden workforce, but there's huge potential for job growth just in terms of there's, I think, about 200 allied health jobs that you could go into.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Kelly. Kelly Weiss, Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter. Your story will air tomorrow morning during Morning Edition, correct?
That's right.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Kelly. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Jeffrey.
And by the way, I just heard from a listener who says, just a note, there is no longer a job called ambulance driver in California. There are EMTs and paramedics. I assume this person is an EMT or a paramedic. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, where do Californians stand on prisons, pensions, and candidates for governor and Senate? We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to capradio.org/insight for links, images, and information about our topics and guests. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, State of the Union analysis and reaction, plus a geographer's perspective on how we view Haiti, and comedians Cheech and Chong back together with their stoner shtick and a new message. Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. What do Californians think about prison spending, public pensions, and the top candidates for governor and U.S. Senate? Answers are in the latest poll, out today, by the Public Policy Institute of California. First, I asked PPIC's Mark Baldessari about prisons. How do Californians feel about the amount of money being spent on corrections compared to education?
Education, in particular K-12 education, but also higher education, we see in our poll are the areas of the budget which Californians say they'd most like to protect from further spending cuts. And interestingly, K-12 education has the strongest level of support when people are asked if they would be willing to pay higher taxes to maintain current level of spending. Prisons, on the other hand, are as we've seen in previous surveys, the area that has the smallest number of people who say that they'd like to protect this area from spending cuts and has the least support for raising taxes to maintain current levels of spending.
Well, I guess from Governor Schwarzenegger's point of view, this is a good news, bad news thing. On the one hand, in the State of the State speech, he called for California to spend more on education, higher education, than in prisons. But he also didn't want to raise taxes. But it sounds like Californians are saying, spend less in prisons and we'd be okay raising taxes to pay more, to spend more on education.
Well, what people were saying in our poll is that they don't want to see any more cuts, you know, particularly to K-12, but also a lot of resistance to the idea of further cuts in higher education. I think where to some degree the governor has hit on a popular theme when he said he doesn't want to make any more cuts to education, and prisons would be the area that he said he would support cuts. Of course, where the controversies come in about his budget proposal right now is the extent to which it does you know, protect K through 12 spending. You know, since he released his budget, there's been, you know, some back and forth between various groups whether or not he's doing what he said he wanted to do, which was to protect K through 12.
My guest is Mark Baldessari, president and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California. We're talking about the PPIC's latest statewide survey, which asked Californians about state spending, see what they thought about the top candidates for big races in California, and also what they think about top government officials in general. Let's talk about where Californians stand on the state's $20 billion or so budget deficit. What do Californians think should be done to close the gap?
About 4 in 10 Californians in our poll say that they think that it's going to require a mix of spending cuts and tax increases. And almost the same number, about 4 in 10, say that they think that this can be accomplished by spending cuts alone. Democrats and Republicans continue to be deeply divided on this issue. Democrats prefer an approach that would include both tax increases and spending cuts. Republicans lean more heavily towards an approach that doesn't involve tax increases. So, you know, we continue to see a partisan divide, as, you know, as we do among the members of our legislature, among the voters.
And it seems like Californians side with Governor Schwarzenegger on his plan, which he's started work on to try and get the federal government to give California billions of dollars. He says the state is owed that money by the feds, and that would help bridge the budget deficit. Quite a lot of Californians seem to think that's a good idea.
Yeah, 2 in 3 Californians this year said that they think that, you know, as part of the budget plan, the state government ought to be asking the federal government for assistance. We saw that last year as well in our poll when we asked the question about the same numbers as this year. And I think clearly Californians are watching at the level of spending with the stimulus plan and other activities from the federal government, and thinking that that should be an area in which we get some more help. That's something that really across the partisan divide, we see Californians siding with the governor on that one.
Let's talk a little bit about the top races in California coming up this year. The U.S. Senate race, Barbara Boxer is up for re-election, and also the governor's race, Governor Schwarzenegger, is termed out. Congressman Tom Campbell was running for the Republican nomination for governor, and he's a former congressman running against two wealthy former technology executives. He's moved into a race that only has one wealthy former technology executive, Carly Fiorina, who's running for U.S. Senate. How's Tom Campbell doing in the Republican race for Senate?
Well, Tom Campbell is leading in the Republican race for Senate at this point. He gets about 27%. Carly Fiorina gets about 16%. Chuck DeVore gets just under 10%. But a lot of people are undecided. A lot of Republican, a lot of people who say they're going to vote in the Republican GOP primary haven't picked a candidate yet, about half of them. But making the move from the governor's race to the Senate race, Tom Campbell now on top with lots of people undecided.
What about the race that Campbell left, the Republican nomination for governor? How has his departure from that race affected the two candidates who are left, Meg Whitman and Steve Poizner?
Meg Whitman is leading in that race by 41% supporting her candidacy, 11% supporting Steve Poizner's candidacy. And we have about the same number undecided as we did a month ago, about 44%, nearly half undecided. So, you know, in both the governor's race and the Senate race on the Republican side, almost half undecided at this stage. So lots of people, you know, I think just still waiting and watching what these candidates have to say.
I'm talking with Mark Baldessari of the Public Policy Institute of California, their latest statewide survey polling California voters. Let's talk now about the Democratic side of those two races. You've got Barbara Boxer, the incumbent U.S. senator. How is she doing? And what about in the governor's race, where there actually is no top-tier Democratic candidate, but Jerry Brown, the attorney general and former governor, is widely expected to announce that he will run?
Well, in our current survey, Barbara Boxer has 49% of California likely voters saying they approve of her performance in office, 44% saying that they disapprove. When she last ran for election, she had slightly more approving, and she had about 10% fewer disapproving. So in this current poll, in which we match up Barbara Boxer against the three Republicans, in each case, her support falls short of a majority. In the case of running against Tom Campbell, there's about a four-point edge. And then in the case of running against Chuck DeVore or Carly Fiorina, an eight-point edge. In each case, her support level is in the mid to high 40s, similar to where her approval rating is. The Republican support, you know, around 40% or so. And so, you know, within a double digit. But it's, of course, very, very early. And I think what these results indicate the most is that strong Democratic support, no doubt, for Barbara Boxer, Democratic voters strongly support her, strong Republican support, no matter who her challenger is among the three, and independents, really not certain where they're going at this point. In the governor's race, we see, as we did last time, an edge of, 5 to 6 points for Jerry Brown against Meg Whitman. And I think just reflecting the fact that strong Democratic support for Brown, strong Republican support for Whitman, and many independents undecided and divided in terms of who they would support at this time. The Poisner race, a bigger spread, 15 points, as similar to what we saw last time in the race against Brown. I think all of this indicating that Jerry Brown has been very quiet. Steve Poisner has yet to really begin to express himself through commercials in the way that Meg Whitman has. And Meg Whitman is getting known. But at this point, I think independent voters are waiting to make up their minds until they hear some more from Democratic and Republican candidates.
And finally, Mark, one other thing in the statewide survey that caught my attention was public employee pensions. You asked Californians what they think about the amount of money spent in the public employee pension system. Where do they stand on this now?
Well, 3 in 4 Californians are now saying that they think the amount that's being spent by state and local government for public employee pensions is a problem. And about 4 in 10 now saying it's a big problem. That's a 10-point increase since we asked that before. I think that public employee pensions, it's an issue which is getting on the radar screen, not just at the state level, but in local levels. And a lot of questions about whether government can afford to have the kinds of pension system that we have. In our poll, about 2 out of 3 Californians said that they would favor seeing new employees, new public employees, move to a 401k plan, which, of course, is similar to what, you know, most people in the private sector and the rest of the nonprofit sector experience. So I think that's where that preference is coming from.
Mark Baldessari, President and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California. We've been talking about the PPIC's latest statewide survey. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a dance show in Sacramento celebrates 50 years of Motown Records. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're looking for interns for Insight. It's a great opportunity for students of communications, journalism, public policy, and several other majors. Go to the careers page at capradio.org for details. Tomorrow, Life with Fibromyalgia, a Modesto woman who used to be editor of a Northern California newspaper, has written a book about living with this painful chronic illness. Also, Stories on Stage, a new series at the Sacramento Poetry Center, where actors read short fiction by local writers. The Motown sound has turned 50. In 1959, producer Berry Gordy founded two record labels in Detroit, Tamla and Motown. In early 1960, he joined them into one company. Over the years, Motown's artists included many of the greatest in pop and soul history, including Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, and Marvin Gaye. A dance show called Motown Jukin' celebrates that music. It's playing at Sacramento State this Sunday evening. It premiered there last October. At that time, I spoke with the show's creators, theater professors Linda Goodrich and Melinda Wilson, and one of the dancers. I asked Linda how they picked songs out of the huge Motown catalog and how they structured those songs into a theater show.
Oh, interesting question. Well, we decided to do the show simply because it is the 50th anniversary of Motown. And I instructed the choreographers for the show to choose dances, well, in consultation with Melinda.
Melinda Wilson, co-director.
Right. To choose songs that help to show Motown's chronology of music. And that's what they looked at first, the whole chronology. And then also pick one that's their favorite. What's their favorite Motown song?
Melinda Wilson, what's your favorite Motown song?
Oh, my favorite. Oh, gosh. It has got to be all the Jackson 5 and
that's
the
right.
Temptations and the Diana Ross and the Supremes are my
Well, that's
big
quite
ones.
A few already.
Yeah, but my all-time favorite Motown song is Melinda by Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. It was a song I was named for. Didn't make its way into the show, but my all-time favorite.
What about you, Linda? What's your favorite Motown song?
Oh, well, I'll tell you. Fingertips, Stevie Wonder. Because for me, that was the start, and I got to see it in Columbus, Ohio. I saw him as a boy.
Little Stevie Wonder.
Little Stevie Wonder, Fingertips.
And he was, what, about 13 then?
He's about 13 years old at
that
the time.
That is crazy when you listen to it.
Yeah, I love it. So I choreographed to it.
Yeah, that's one of the songs that's featured
right.
in the show.
That's right.
I think there's a trio of Stevie Wonder songs. There's Fingertips,
Overjoyed,
and
Master Blaster.
That's an interesting choice to go from Fingertips to Overjoyed.
Now, those are some of my favorites, right. And I wanted to showcase the dancers in Overjoy as a lyrical kind of modern dance and fit that into the theme somewhere. And we were able to do it.
Michael Smith is one of the actors and dancers. Michael, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today, Jeff?
Well, I'm doing well. Some of these songs date back before your time.
Yes, quite a few. But I grew up with my grandma, my grandpa, my mom. They're wonderful people. My grandpa was actually a doo-wop singer, so I was raised mostly on old-time school songs. Like even today's music is okay, and you know, you have the beats, but I like the old-time schools. They had lyrics and they had meanings to it. Mm-hmm. My grandpa was a part of this group called the Elgins, and so I love that kind of music. It's my favorite type of music for me.
Which songs do you dance to in the show?
In the show, I danced to quite a few songs. I danced to Dr. Gurridge's Sweet Soul, which is the name of her entire piece. So I danced to Fingertips, Overjoyed, and Master Blast. And I also danced to Stevie Wonder's... what's the title of that song?
Which one?
The one I do the tribute. They Won't
oh,
Go When I Go.
They Won't Go When I Go.
They Won't Go When I Go. Actually, mm-hmm. I would say that's my favorite mm-hmm. out of the entire show is because... Mm-hmm. It's really a very emotional
and it's
piece.
It's what they played at the memorial.
You also hear Do Pride and Joy.
I do. There are a lot. They're just a lot.
I was listening to those three Stevie Wonder songs earlier this morning, and how do you go as a dancer from Fingertips, which is this frenetic sort of gospel soul type early 60s thing, to Overjoyed, which is, you know, an 80s R&B mellow classic?
I would have to say it's more of that inward thing you go when you're just acting and stuff like that as well. Like you go from this super high like energy, it's like kind of like a party, everyone's here, we're having fun, to Overjoy, and you go back into your ballet mode, but you also listen to the lyrics as well. The mm-hmm. lyrics that are in the song help to develop the emotion that you feel as a dancer on stage, and so it's easy to switch back and mm-hmm. forth because we all have emotional ties that we can put with each one of the songs.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the show, the dance show Motown Jukin, which is playing at Sacramento State through November 1st. My guests are the co-directors Linda Goodrich and Melinda Wilson. They're both professors at the Department of Theater and Dance at Sacramento State, and Michael Smith, who's one of the actors and dancers. Melinda, what was your role?
I came into this show when Linda had the idea. I'm the faculty advisor for Sons and Ancestors Players, which is the Black theater company on campus. So the show is a collaboration between SBAD and Sons and Ancestors Players. And we came into the show over the summer when we decided to do Motown Juke and to try to create a through line and fill in some of the gaps. One of the things we did was once the dancers decided what songs they were using, we said, well, the Supremes isn't here, so let's do a piece on the Supremes. And there's a piece on the Temptations, so let's do something with the Temptations to introduce the Temptations piece. So we sort of filled in the gaps to help create the storyline for the Motown part. Mm-hmm. And then I think I really got involved when it was the summer when Michael Jackson passed away that we decided to make the first act Motown and the second act a tribute to Michael Jackson. And that's when we started saying, okay, what's the second act going to look like?
Are the actors and dancers all students at Sac State?
That's right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some are community members, but they're former members of Sacramento Black Art of Dance.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of Michael Jackson, this new film, This Is It, which is based on video footage of rehearsals of his upcoming 50 shows that were going to be in London. And, of course, the shows never happened because Michael Jackson passed away, but this has been assembled into a documentary by his collaborator on this whole project. And, Linda, I understand you saw it on opening night.
The film is phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. You're going to come away from that film seeing that that man is a genius. Not was. He is an American icon, and he's a gift to the world because anyone who is in the, you know, has to go through the performance process can look at that and see that man was at the top of his form. He really was at the top of his form.
There was so much speculation before he died about his health and how he was within himself. How does he look when you watch him on the film?
He looks fabulous. He's thoroughly engaged physically. He's doing everything, absolutely everything. I was just so shocked because I expected to see someone who was emaciated, someone who was not able to keep up with the process. He was involved every step of the way. And even if they chose only the best of the best in all of that footage, you can't fake that. As in the soul world, you say, you can't fake the funk. He could not fake that.
And you were at the Michael Jackson Memorial Service at the Staples Center in Los Angeles in July. A lot of great Motown stars were there.
Yes. That's why I still have my bracelet. It's going to have to disintegrate off. This is the bracelet they put on you when you to get your tickets. That memorial was absolutely one of the most reverent services I've ever been to. It made every 17,000 people in the Staples Center feel like you were part of the family.
It was a homegoing service.
Yeah, it was a homegoing in the real tradition of black culture.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Michael, what's your favorite Michael Jackson song?
Oh, that's a hard one. I would have to say Bad.
Yeah?
I love that song. Yeah. This is one, because especially there's this one dance move that you see. He's like just kind of like chugging across the floor with all this. It was amazing. Yeah. And like if you look closely, you see like some of the actors and stuff as well who are like in NYPD Blue or I can't remember who it was. But you're like, oh, I know this person. But that song is, it's so great because then he's like, I can't even put it into words. It's just a great song.
Melinda? Mm-hmm.
Man in the Mirror.
Ah, yes.
I saw Michael Jackson on the Bad Tour in Dallas and the finale encore was Man in the Mirror. And I remember we were so hyped, me and my sisters, but when that song came on, I became one of those millions of fans that you see crying their eyes out and hyperventilating. But Man in the Mirror is my all-time favorite Michael Jackson song.
And Linda, in just a couple of seconds, your favorite Michael Jackson song?
My favorite Michael Jackson is Thriller.
Great.
And Earth. I love Earth. Yes.
All songs. I love that song.
Yes, Earth.
That song in childhood made me cry. Mm-hmm.
My guests, the co-directors, Melinda Wilson and Linda Goodrich, and one of the actor-dancers, Michael Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you,
Jeffrey.
Motown Jukin plays one time only this Sunday evening at 6 at Sacramento State University Theater. It premiered last October when I talked with Linda, Melinda, and Michael. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, new indie music releases on this week's edition of Sound Advice. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's an Insight podcast. Go to capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, the struggling Sacramento and Central Valley region saw their foreclosure numbers drop in the last quarter of 2009 compared with the previous 3 months. But a research firm that tracks this says the drop was mainly due to government measures like moratoriums. Despite the drop, Merced, Stockton, and Modesto among the nation's top six markets for foreclosures, Sacramento number 15. That story and more later today on All Things Considered. Each Thursday, it's our weekly music feature, Sound Advice. This week, new releases from the indie world with Nick Bruner, host of Capital Public Radio's online music show Off Air. Nick, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. Good to be back.
Well, the latest show uploaded satisfactorily, but you're up late.
Yes, I did. Much of that came from editing an interview with a very, very funny comedian named Ngayo Bilom, and he's going to be hosting a comedy benefit for Haiti at the Punchline on February 2nd.
Now, is he the guy with the big fat spliff in his mouth on your webpage?
That would be him. He happens to have many opinions about the legalization of marijuana, if you could believe it.
Well, let's listen to some music. Who do you have for us this week?
Well, this first band is one that I've trotted out for Sound Advice once before. We play a handful of tracks from their new record. It's the Magnetic Fields, and this song is called You Must Be Out of Your Mind.
You want what you turned off, turned on. You call it sunset, now it's dawn.
Magnetic Fields, You Must Be Out of Your Mind. You've got another song by them on the latest Off Air.
Yeah, I believe there's three. A little back history, I think, is in order. Their last album was called Distortion and had a theme of, as you might guess, distortion on all the vocals and the tracks, and they used a lot of synthesizers. Well, this is kind of like the opposite image of distortion. This new record is called Realism. The lead singer calls it his folk album, and it's all played without any synthesizers. It's very crisp, very clean, very pretty.
That's a pretty shocking transformation.
Well, the Magnetic Fields are great at that. They love to produce concept album. Well, I don't know if you call it a concept album. It's not like a prog rock fighting dinosaurs and dragons record, but it's very, they're almost always based around a certain theme or some kind of concept of that nature.
But I think the dinosaur fighters would like that mandolin sound, though. You know,
they
from
may.
Back in the old Led Zeppelin
right
days.
Before everything just breaks out into just a shrieky guitar solo, high-pitched wail. They may.
Nick Bruner, host of Off Air Capital Public Radio's online music show. It's at smartrockradio.org. He's our guest once a month on Sound Advice with new releases. Who's our next artist?
You know, I realize now that I should have started this whole segment with a disclaimer. It's tough. I mean, clearly we don't have enough time to share an entire song during segments on Insight. And every time I have to whittle down a song to play for this, I always feel like I'm slicing up somebody else's child. That sounds a little morbid.
Whoa.
It's rough, but especially with this new record by a great band called Beach House. Their new record is called Teen Dream, and maybe you'll see what I'm talking about here.
Thank you.
That's really nice. What's the song called?
The song's called Zebra, and it's the lead-off track from their album. And I always feel like it's tough to whittle that down because there's such a beautiful lead-in that just swells and grows and is just very, very, very pretty.
Yeah. Anything else you can tell us about Beach House?
Well, the band is relatively new. I can tell you that this album has a DVD that goes along with it, and the DVD has a video for each song on it.
Wow, that's a big investment.
And if you happen to like what you just heard, you can swing by NPR's music site right now. They have the entire record up to stream all the way through. So if you want to listen to it all the way through, you can do that and see if you want to pick it up.
And that song is on the latest edition of Off Air, hosted by Nick Bruner and produced by Nick Bruner. And this is Sound Advice on Insight. Well, we've had two artists so far. Who's the third?
The third actually comes from a record company that's based out of Sacramento. The company is called Waga Records. One of the guys who works there, Matt Kilborn, contacted us through Facebook, and we actually came to Wanderlust, a music festival from last summer. And he sent us this record by a band called Fur, and it's entirely instrumental. The record's called Witches, and the song is called Haunted.
That the band is called Fur. It sounds like good music for some funky mad scientist cooking up a crazy experiment.
Oh yes it does. It's really nice, just really groove based instrumental music you can just nod your head, space out to. It's really good to just kind of kick back and go about your day with. It's pretty stuff.
Is this typical of the music on their record?
Yes it is.
They're called Fur, but it seems like it's capitalized. Does it stand for something? Do you know? F-U-R?
It is not an anagram. Not anagram.
Acronym.
Acronym, thank you. That's why you host
acronym
this show.
Acronym Ohio.
No, not an acronym as far as I can tell. It's just all capitals to grab your attention.
And the record label, Waga, is from Sacramento, but the band is not.
The band is not. I can't tell you off the top of my head where they're based out of, but I can come back and do that.
They're not Sactown. Before we listen to another one, let's just take a quick detour into the Grammys. The Music Awards are this Sunday evening. Any thoughts, reflections, praise, criticism?
Oh, you know, the Grammys are such a weird beast because, you know, you've got your typical, you know, your usual suspects, your Beyoncés, your Taylor Swifts, your Black Eyed Peas. They're all going to be there. They're all up for one award or another.
And the big awards.
Yeah, well, the big, you know, the eye-catching awards at the end of the night. And, you know, it's, you know, the bands that we play on Off Air usually miss that scope altogether. But what surprised me was that the band management, or capital M, capital G, capital M, capital T, those guys are up for Best New Artist, which to me seems like a real sort of misnomer, because those guys formed back in 2005. You know, I mean, this is like the perfect example of sort of what I think the Grammys are just kind of out of touch, because they formed in 2005. They had a top slot on a lot of festivals, Lollapalooza, Coachella, South by Southwest, Rosclyde, Reading, Bonnaroo. And for God's sake, the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, pirated their song in his re-election bid last year. So, you know, pardon my eye rolling if at 2010 calling them a new artist seems just a little bit kind of like, where have you been, Grammy people?
Yeah, that's a fair reflection. Some artists that you've played, not just on Off Air, but in the Sound Advice segments on Insight show up. For example, David Byrne and Brian Eno in the Best Alternative Music Album, Everything That Happens Will Happen Today. That was really cool.
Yeah, certainly. Those guys are well-deserving of that award. Sure, why not? Surprised they're not calling them the best new artists of the 2010.
Yeah, even the Grammys would be pushed there.
Who is this David Byrne?
Yeah.
Talking what?
Well, let's go back to music. Who's the next artist you have for us this week?
Well, Fur, actually, the band we played before, transitions nicely into this next artist because starting today is the first day of the Sacramento Electronica Music Festival. And I've got a cut from a guy who, I didn't realize it, but he turns out he's a Sacramento native. I've been listening to him for a handful of years, even before I moved to California. This guy's name is Tycho, and he's gained prominence in his scene, predominantly, for putting out records on a very big label called Ghostly International, known for, you know, instrumentals and electronica music. This song is called The Daydream.
Very nice. Tycho, the song called The Daydream. And yeah, it does come nicely out of Fur. It's music you could listen to satisfactorily in all manner of states, including at work.
Indeed. I've listened to Tycho and his label mates while just trying to write up something for Capital Public Radio or for off air. It's really good just to, I mean, it just puts you in a certain state of mind that kind of, it's repetitive, but it's engaging at the same time. I don't know, it's a unique mix.
And we just have seconds left, but just quickly,
oh, God.
The interview with, if I'm saying his name correctly, Ngayo?
Ngayo Bilom.
Ngayo Bilom. Tell us a little bit more about him.
Ngayo Bilom is a Sacramento comedian, and he's very, very funny. I first saw him perform at Luna's in downtown Sacramento, and he is going to be headlining this benefit for Haiti on the 2nd of February with a lot of other Sacramento comedians. 100% of the proceeds goes to the Red Cross and other organizations.
And he's booked for Insight on Monday, I'm just informed.
Is he? Well, how did
informed
that happen?
Slash reminded. Well, that's great. We'll look forward to talking with him on Insight. You can hear all kinds of good stuff on Off Air. It's uploaded every midnight on Wednesday leading into Thursday, and the latest one is up there. You can get it at smartrockradio.org. Nick Bruner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producer was Mara Ponce. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Tomorrow we'll be asking for your support. Thank you for joining us. What your doctor doesn't know about fibromyalgia is a new book by a Modesto woman. On the next Insight, she'll tell you what it's really like to live with this painful chronic disease. Plus, Stories on Stage, a new monthly series featuring short fiction from local writers read by local actors. You'll meet the host and two of the debut participants. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.